Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
The president was conveying this to you at the White House.
In the Oval Office.
And he told you that he'd had a personal conversation with President Putin about hookers?
Yes.
It's not okay for the president of the United States to say a private citizen should be in jail. It's not normal. It's not acceptable. It's not okay.
They both can't be right that I'm in the other team's pocket. The challenge of being the FBI in today's political environment is you're not on anybody's side. That confuses people, which I get, and it angers people, which I also get.
Hello, and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about the man who heard from Vladimir Putin that Russia has the most beautiful prostitutes, Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg, and I'm here with Virginia Heffernan, and we're here with two copies of James Comey's new book, A Higher Loyalty. And we have done something that very few people talking about the book have done. We've read it, Virginia.
We've read it cover to cover.
I've read every page of this book.
I have read every page except the excerpts about Trump that I had already read. I did want to see in what context he drops the stories, the well-known stories that he gave in the testimony and that we've now seen in the memos.
Before we get into it, I have a lot to ask you about this book, but we have to talk briefly about our live show coming up on May 30th at the Bell House in Brooklyn. I'm so excited about this show because we haven't done a real live show in New York. It's going to be really fun. We are going to have the people who have been doing the improv on our show. Steve Waltine, Kate James, and Asher Perlman are going to be doing some of their sketch comedy for us.
And it's improv, some of it, right? Like, they come up with their sketches. They're barely scripted. They often come into the studio.
They're not scripted. They come in the studio and they record
four of them
in 45 minutes. It's unbelievable. I want people to see how they do this. It's so great.
I think that's going to be the best part. For tickets to that, go to slate.com/live. That's slate.com/live.
Yes. And if you have any suggestions for the show, let us know. You can tweet at us at Real Trumpcast. So this book, Virginia, I really liked it. And I didn't expect to like it, but I want to, before we get into our opinions, I just want to ask you about what you thought about Comey before you read the book and how it changed your view of him at all. Did it change your view of Comey?
It did. I knew, it's funny because the word about him that was, I think, almost always leveraged was sanctimonious, or he was sometimes called self-righteous, and that got in his way. It was a kind of moral hubris that led him to make a bad decision. The question of whether he was ill-intentioned or not, I didn't know. But as for sanctimony, I think one of the first things he tells us is that he's prone to sanctimony. I get the feeling that he's always telling people that he's prone to sanctimony and correcting for it. There's a level of neurosis in him. That not sanctimony, but just almost like a Hamlet, like, am I doing it right? Am I doing it right? How am I coming across? Have I consulted my principles? You know, what does this person think of me? How's he acting? Is he trying to pressure me? He contrasts himself to Robert Mueller in the book and clearly considers himself, he has the flaw almost of overthinking He even says that some bad leaders get analysis paralysis, and he seems to have done that at times.
This is fascinating. I think you've gotten right to the heart of what is really interesting to me about James Comey as a person and the way he portrays himself. He says right at the beginning, you're right, right in the author's note at the beginning about how he can be prideful and overconfident and driven by ego. And then he says, I underline this passage much further along in the book, where he says, the stuff that gets to me most is the claim that I am in love with my own righteousness, my own virtue. And he said, I've long worried about my ego. I'm proud of the fact that I try to do the right thing. I'm proud of the fact that I try to be truthful and transparent. So he's both denying and admitting that at the same time, this righteous quality, he's sort of saying, I hate that people accuse me of this. And the reason he hates it is there's kind of something to it. But what is that line? I mean, it's not necessarily contradictory to think about doing the right thing and also think about your reputation for doing the right thing.
Yes.
I think Comey pretty clearly, if you read this book, I mean, I think he sort of lays it on the table in what was to me a very compelling way. I don't think there's another secret James Comey who has evil motives and, you know, tries thinking about his career. I mean, he's clearly a guy who goes through life thinking about the right thing to do, but also with being seen as a guy who does the right thing and is morally reflective. And it is a funny, I don't know that it paralyzes him, but, you know, there's a quality people like, which is the quality of being ethical and doing the right thing and thinking about doing the right thing. And there's a quality people don't like, which is the Reverend Comey thing and the idea that he's
the meddlesome priest.
You know, you know, you're holier than thou, or you're righteous, or you think you're better than other people. Clearly rubs Trump and the Trump people the wrong way. I mean, that gets under their skin about Comey that he thinks he's in the
also,
right.
I think also, you know, we were, I was part of this, as you know, Slow Burn live event last night. And I think Bob Woodward at it, I'm name dropping, but I'll just go ahead. The next name I'm going to drop is Archibald Cox.
Who was not on the panel with you.
Bob Woodward said that, you know, was talking about how Nixon disliked that Archibald Cox, you know, was a Harvard person. And there's something in the, James Comey seems like he might strike Trump as someone who thinks he's better than other people. And Comey, this is a higher loyalty. There's something elevated, physically elevated, and, you know, even an idealistic about Comey. You know, he likes the idea that he's uncorruptible. And, you know, Trump, whom Comey says used the art of the deal techniques on him. Do you remember that? He says, like, he's still doing his art of the deal thing. He might have said that in the memos, but Trump likes to think that everybody's corruptible, that everyone has a price or can be blackmailed or can be pushed around and has an agenda. And Comey likes to think he doesn't have an agenda and that, you know, he can't be corrupted. And so there's just this wonderful battle between them, just as a kind of literary story. It just, I couldn't get enough of this.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, Trump is, you know, is corrupt and says everyone's corrupt. And Comey has an enormous stake in his integrity and, you know, clearly goes through a kind of anguish when it's challenged. But it does set him up in a certain way. I mean, this is the guy who had Reinhold Niebuhr as his secret Twitter handle, you know, who is always quoting Thomas More at you. And, you know, as much as I liked his book and found it really sincere, there is a certain lack of irony or just earthy humanity about someone who has that quality of righteousness.
You know, he says, I think he says one thing he admires about leaders, because I will say this book is not just an effort to extenuate his actions in the 2016 election, as much as we want to play it that way and pick sides. It really is a meditation on leadership. And some of the other, these books that are coming out so fast, mostly they're quotes, and then there's like prose stuff around them for the quotes to hang on. But this really, I mean, I think the way he walks us through his early mob prosecutions in the late 80s, early 90s, through the prosecution of the Black Mayor of Richmond, which I think was very interesting, where he had to kind of tried to turn a young Black minister on him, the Martha Stewart prosecution, which led him to believe that, you know, no celebrity in some cases, no woman was above being jailed for lying.
Let me just interrupt you there. It's interesting, Virginia. So he recounts these early cases when he was a prosecutor, first in the Southern District of New York, where he had the job Giuliani had before him, and then in Richmond, Virginia, I think it was. And the thread in all of them is I and we in the prosecutor's office wanted to be merciful. But in the end, we couldn't because these people wouldn't admit their wrongdoing and tell the truth.
Yeah,
and
one
thing you can never forgive is lying to the FBI or lying to the Justice Department. If only these people had thrown themselves on the mercy of the court, i.e. us, we could have, you know, we could have let them go with a slap on the wrist. Instead, they had to go to jail.
It also is when he's talking about financial crimes and Martha Stewart, who fits this paradigm exactly. He kind of inadvertently gives some clues to would-be white-collar criminals, because white-collar criminals like the presidents of the banks in 2008, he says, can almost always get away with what they did, because so much of it is about their state of mind when they did something, and often they can just plead, I didn't understand this leveraging and this derivative, and someone else must have messed this up. But so he says, if you just say X, they would be fine, but they lie, and then we have them. It was interesting to me that so many crimes, you know, he contrasted these white collar crimes. And I get the sense there's a little bit of thinking toward whatever prosecution of Trump might take place, how hard these prosecutions are without a smoking gun and without a bag of heroin in the room where everybody knows what they're doing is wrong. You know, it might very well be that with a Mike Flynn, for example, you know, he might not have thought that making those calls was wrong or working, or he might at least claim those things. And as long as he doesn't lie going forward, he might get away with it. Or at least that's a suggestion, I think, in some of the parables in higher loyalty.
I admire James Comey. And I think, you know, our country really depends in a way it hasn't before on there being people with a Comey-like sense of integrity, particularly in the judicial branch and in the justice function of government.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like I would want to be friends with Comey. He's too much of a stiff.
Well, isn't it also interesting? I mean, he uses this phrase, comfortable in his own skin, and it says that that's important in a leader, that they be comfortable. And he's at pains to show us he's comfortable in his own skin when he explains that he keeps saying, I like to promote a sense of fun around the office. For example, I once made a pun. And I mean, he says it more than once, you know, that he's very jolly and that he's, you know, he keeps telling us how likable he is. At the same time, damn it, like that whole account of how brutally bullied he was growing up in, was it when they moved from Yonkers to Palisades or something? And he tells us, lest we don't know, what a wedgie is and gets us to feel it in our own butts. I mean, that's writing.
It was very vivid, but you know,
then you want to bully him. Yeah. I was just like, yeah, I would find you annoying too. I might have cheered on the wedgie.
But the compelling thing is, you know, he does that. You've heard that move before. I was bullied, so I take the side of the underdog. But he says, you know, the really important episode was this time when I was a bully, when I kind of joined with the mob and, you know, bullied this kid who was a little weird in college.
Right. Yeah.
And he says that's
who talked endlessly about his hometown girlfriend.
Right. I mean, you got the picture, you know, but that's like but in a way, I found that to be the really compelling thing. This is a guy whose consciousness is, I can't join the mob. I can't join the mob.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go along because they want me to go along. And that was why he ended up being such a hero in the Bush administration, you know, in the famous hospital bed scene, which even if you know that story, he recounts really, really well in kind of riveting detail in this book.
Wait, can you retell the story? Because talk about an excerpt that has not been pulled out of this book and is fascinating and historically interesting.
Yeah, and I actually thought that was the little passage in the book, the 30 pages or whatever it is that I enjoyed the most. So basically what happened was they had this warrantless wiretapping program, and Jack Goldsmith, who was head of the Office of Legal Counsel, said it wasn't legal. The authorization of it was dubious, and they were going beyond
post 9/11 heavy surveillance
after September 11th. And it followed what had happened with this torture memo, where Goldsmith had withdrawn this torture memo, which the CIA had used for justification. Anyway, there was a huge showdown with people from the White House, particularly from Dick Cheney's office, facing off against the Justice Department officials led by Comey. And And what happened was John Ashcroft, who was the attorney general, was rushed to the hospital with this dire pancreatitis.
Mm-hmm.
And the White House people, backed up by the Secret Service, were rushing to one side of the bed, and the Comey people, the Justice Department people, backed by the FBI, were rushing to the other side of the bed, and they were almost at the point of having a physical altercation. Cheney people and the Bush people wanted to get the semi-conscious Ashcroft to put his signature mm-hmm. on this dubious renewal of this program, which eventually was thrown out and limited in scope. Anyway, but what's sort of interesting about that story to me is that Comey just, it becomes very intense for him that he's just not going to go along just because because everyone thinks one thing and because they're kind of bullying him and pressuring him to do it. And they're telling him, you know, thousands of people could die if you don't renew this permission we have to do this kind of wiretapping.
That's right. Yeah. He quotes himself as having said to Cheney, "That makes me feel bad, but I stand behind this."
The law is the law. He's a lawman. You know, he's not going to break the law because someone tells him he has to. And now, that's his identity.
Thinking of that hospital bed, that like incredibly vivid scene that he paints, what instantly comes to mind, having just finished this book, is Cheney is a gangster, mobster, like on the Mafia Don thing. He's trying to like strong arm Comey into making a bad decision. Gonzalez, I think, is, he puts in a kind of weak category. Like
Alberto Gonzalez, who was the White House counsel. Yeah.
Oh, White House counsel.
Later the AG.
I think Obama, he puts Obama a little bit in that category. Nice guy, but not. He makes a big point of saying that he didn't support Obama, which is interesting, that he didn't support Obama for the presidency. This is Comey.
I thought he was very, very positive about Obama in general. He thinks Obama has a little of this hubris arrogance. He thinks, you know, Obama has too much faith in his own brilliance and judgment. But
he's very,
on ethical
very
grounds, he's 100% on Obama's
yes,
side
and
everywhere.
And he came around to him. So he didn't support him, I think, for the presidency.
No, he's a Republican. I mean, that's clear, right?
Yeah.
His views are Republican views.
That's clear. But, you know, when you talk about, so Cheney's a bully. Giuliani earlier, you get to know, is a bully, that he basically runs the Southern District, even in their prosecution of the mob, like the mob. And so he sort of mirrors the structure of that. And there's one, now that Giuliani may have joined Trump's legal team, or seems to have joined Trump's legal team. And also, if you take into account the Byzantine story of Giuliani's influence on the rogue New York FBI field office, it becomes even more poignant what Comey says. The maxim of the 90s was, there's no more dangerous place to be than between Giuliani and the microphone. And those are the things that Comey is observing all along about, why is Cheney an asshole and a bad leader? Why is Giuliani a leader and a bad leader and an asshole? And all the way up to Trump. Those are the counterexamples, the cautionary tales of bad leadership that he's illustrating in the book. I don't know.
And George W. Bush, I would point out, who he says is kind of a bully too.
Yes, that's right. And weird things, like he starts his meetings early, which drives Comey crazy and led to the embarrassment of one of his underlings that he really thought was unconscionable, and also that he had a temper. Yeah, he doesn't like how
he sort of lords it over people and is always looking for, you know, makes fun of people with this kind of cruel edge that is to establish his superior position.
Yes.
And this goes back to this bullying thing we were talking about Comey's very attuned to bullies and bullying.
But I also think he's a writer. And Obama, incidentally, when I read Dreams from My Father, I thought, oh, Obama's fundamentally a writer. Like, there are not that many presidents that have had, like, thoroughgoing literary imaginations. You know, I'd almost put Comey up there with Obama. And he takes the writer's revenge. I've done this myself. You write about a person that you know, think is kind of a jerk and who's successful in our non-pointy-headed world, you know, maybe an athlete or whatever, and you just describe some physical detail because all you have, your weapons of the week, are your little language and your little ability to say that his, you know, tanning goggles have left this mark on him. I mean, he's the president. He has fired him. So why not use the power of the pen to strike back a little bit.
The writing's pretty good. I don't think it's the level of Obama's first book, but it's surprisingly good, especially since he doesn't seem to have had a ghostwriter. I mean, he doesn't credit one.
I know.
So he is an editor, but I think he sat down and wrote this thing. And those details, I mean, I didn't find them petty. I thought they were just the kind of description that makes something vivid. And he did it pretty well. I mean, it's not an A-plus piece of writing, but for a lawyer and for someone with his kind of career doing his first book, he pulls it off.
He's
with
a lot better than my hero, Hillary Clinton. He's a lot better. Trying to think of some of the memoirs this year, but I thought it's quite surprising that way. But that is because, and here's where I'm going to propose something controversial. That's because I do think it's a book about leadership that he's planned for a long time. He's been studying these figures, including the woman whose name I've forgotten, who initiated him into the SDNY, preceded Giuliani, I think. Is that right?
No, I think you're talking about the woman who was the U.S. attorney in Virginia, who he worked for, who was a big mentor to him, whose name I also forgot.
Okay, we can go back on that one. You know, he talks about formative experiences, like losing a very young baby, which is, you know, no small thing, and his wife having to endure that, and also his enduring the bullying, and we left out this violent crime that he was a victim of. But anyway, so he comes up, he's been scrutinizing other people sort of to see how he should behave and apprenticing himself to other people. You think instead of Robert Mueller, who, you know, is always described as essentially having his own moral compass, having no self-doubt. This Comey is the opposite of that. He's really trying to mirror the people around him, find people he should be, shouldn't be. Okay, so here's the thing. He tells you how he stuck out like a sore thumb and, you know, ultimately, literally when he became 6'8", and that he was, you know, he's constantly knocking his head on, you know, on door frames, at being asked if he played basketball. He didn't. And generally feeling quite awkward, I think, in his body, and also telling you he's an individual. He doesn't need to fit in. All right. Stay with me. Mimi Rocha yesterday, former also federal prosecutor at SDNY, was talking about mobs and flipping witnesses, sort of apropos of, like, are we going to be, is the FBI going to flip Michael Cohen? And what she said is that when people flip from the mafia, they're great witnesses for the government. Why? Because they are joiners. They want to belong to something. And they go from, I'm a person who lies for the boss, to I'm a person who tells the truth for the country. Yeah. You know, you think about Papadopoulos right now. He thought he was doing the best thing for the country by promoting Trump abroad and trying to get him elected. And now he thinks he's a hero if you follow him and his wife on Twitter for the nation. You know, he's just, his allegiances have switched, but he's an exponent of a new thing. You know, we talk about Comey as an individualist. Comey is FBI through and through. Mm. He talks about it all the time, and he feels like he was finally accepted and loved. And if there's anything you can fault him for, it's blind allegiance to the FBI. I think blind allegiance when the facts come out about the pressure he got from the rogue FBI field office that he doesn't talk a lot about, from Giuliani, his old boss, who he says intimidated him and was influencing that office, and the leaks they were doing along the way. We may learn that in October 2016, he was responding to more mob-like pressures than he admits to. Those mob pressures coming from an office that, by his own admission, acted like the mob. I mean, it's really a fascinating story. It's Shakespearean on some level, I think.
I mean, if I wanted to make a case on Trump's side against Comey,
yeah,
what I would say is you read his book and you see that this guy who prosecuted the mafia sees mafias everywhere on the other side, that he's developed this prosecutorial mentality. And he clearly, from the beginning, sees the Trump organization as a mafia.
Yeah, first blush.
So you go in with that mindset and you've decided, I'm the guy who fights the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
You've decided you're fighting a new mafia just by their attitudes, by their behavior, by the kind of organization it is, before you've kind of seen the evidence. So the case would be that he's rushed to judgment against the Trump people, and that Trump, you know, figured out in the first meetings that, you know, he was asking for loyalty from this guy, which was crazy. He was never going to get any loyalty from James Comey. But what he should have been asking for is fairness. You know, Trump should have been saying, don't judge me based on appearances.
Yeah.
And you know, this isn't necessarily what I think, but I do think Comey had an idea in his head what he was dealing with the Trump people. And I think that idea was right. But I think he, you know, there was probably a kind of presumption about their how ethical their behavior was that may have gotten a little bit ahead of the evidence.
I mean, you, Mimi Rocha was saying yesterday that she sees, you know, she has this kind of almost religious fervor about FDNY in particular and the FBI. And she says that they think of themselves as like emergency room doctors who, you know, will treat even the worst racist, even the worst murderer and scoundrel who comes in, like instantly sort of stop the bleeding. But what's interesting is they're talking about prosecution, not about what I would think would be analogous to the ER, which is some kind of defense. I mean, you come from a tradition of we defend the Nazis and the, you know, Jews alike, their rights under the Constitution. This is a slightly different thing, which is that I go after with equal vigor everyone from Martha Stewart to a black minister to, you know, that I show no mercy for anyone, you know.
And that criminal organization, right.
And that criminal organization, right. And once he puts them in that category, and I think, you know, it's the thing that distinguishes the Trump organization from the mafia very clearly to me is that there doesn't seem to be any violence associated with the Trump organization, even its connections to the Russian mafia. You know, you can get two steps removed from human trafficking if you think about the money laundered in Panama and some of the money laundered in the U.S. But it's really not like, you know, when he talks about flipping Sammy the Bull Grabano and it making, in my head, I make that analogous to Michael Cohen. Sammy the Bull Grabano had killed 40 people, strangled 40 people.
I mean, but remember, you know? the great goal of the mafia is always to get into legitimate business and
yes.
out of all the dirty business.
Right.
Right. So they want to move up the food chain. So if you're already up the food chain, you don't move down the food chain into racketeering and shaking people down for nickels and dimes.
Yes.
Right? You're doing, you know, you're into money laundering and stock manipulation.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think the Trump organization, we have to be careful, but may have assisted a mafia-like moves at the level of money laundering. But what's weird is Bob Woodward was saying last night, there's going to be no smoking gun here. I don't agree. I think we already have a smoking gun in some of the indictments here being with Trump. But I don't think we're going to find the kind of violent crimes that lead people necessarily to flip the way they did with Grabano and the crime families in New York.
All right, two other things we've got to talk mm-hmm. about. First of all, these memos that have come out, AP got a hold of Comey's actual memos that he describes in the book.
It's something like an hour after they were declassified. I mean, we can't even call it leaks. It's just like
declassified. Who cares? But did it add anything? I mean, it's my reading of them, which was a little hasty. It just seemed to substantiate. I mean, Comey wrote this account having the memos in his files, at least the declassified versions. And it seemed, I mean, there were a few bits that were cut for space, sort of, but it seemed pretty consistent with the story he tells, right?
I mean, I was interested in how the dialogue was done in Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury. And we get a little bit of how the dialogue is sort of transmogrified by Comey between the memos in which he memorialized the conversations, he says, 5 minutes after they ended, and the finished product. So it was interesting to me to see, for instance, that Trump greeted the news that the Kremlin had tapes of him cavorting with prostitutes at the Ritz in 2013. The first thing he said in Comey's immediate memory was, there were no prostitutes. There were never prostitutes. And he has that in quotation marks. In this, and then he says, I don't go there, which Comey takes to mean I don't have to pay for sex. He changes the language of that a lot in the book. I don't quite understand that, but there were no prostitutes. There were never prostitutes. To me, that sounds like they were strippers, you know, or like I didn't pay for them. Somebody else paid for them.
Pragu.
Yes, exactly. Or Pragu. You got a detail wrong here. They were pageant, you know, people.
All right, my view as a
but
close...
But they were definitely something from that statement. I felt, I mean, obviously we all care, is the Steele dossier true? And by that we mean, was there pee on a mattress on the Ritz? That's the only thing we ever care about. But that was interesting to me.
Virginia, my previous position was that the pee tape was preposterous because who would let people pee in a bed that either you're going to sleep in or even another bed in the same hotel room. You don't want to sleep in a room with a bed that's been peed on. But Trump's defense is that he didn't even sleep in the room.
That's right.
So suddenly it's plausible again, which Comey doesn't realize.
This is only for just like insane connoisseurs of this conversation with Comey. But we should recognize that Keith Schiller has already given the lie to Trump's repeated claim to Comey that he didn't spend the night in the room. They did, in fact, spend that night there. But a presidential suite, I'm sure, has many soft couches. And Trump doesn't seem to need a lot of sleep anywhere.
You don't want to sleep in a room that somebody's peed in.
Even after, just for scent reasons.
Think about it.
Well, you know, look, he's the president. That's not true, but he's Donald Trump. He's in the presidential suite. I bet he can get some people up there to change the mattress or whatever it takes. Anyway, I like your forensics, though.
Yes, I could have been a special agent. All right. Last thing I got to ask you about.
Also, incidentally, they peed on each other, if the dossier is to be believed. So maybe none of it got on the mattress.
We someday we'll get to the bottom of this.
We need to understand bladder sizes, content.
Okay. I remain skeptical.
All right.
Hillary Clinton, you certainly were someone, as was I, who was very upset about Comey's behavior running up to the election and particularly announcing on October 29th the reopening of the email investigation,
right,
which a lot of people think cost Hillary Clinton the election. Whether it did or not, you know, the thing he has been most attacked for is making that announcement. Did reading his version of it make you think differently about that decision of his?
I really, really think he underplays this the role of the New York FBI office, which that just hasn't come to light.
So Comey does say that one of the reasons he decided to make the announcement was that he was worried it would leak before the election and that would be worse. And that would have presumably come from the FBI New York field office or from the Southern District of New York prosecutors.
Right. But when he gets to, I just had to be even handed and that's why I did it. Not the leaks thing, but when he says, you know, even the content of what he said in that press conference, you know, that saving to the end the idea that she wasn't under investigation and leading with a description of her, what does he say, recklessness in using this email server. I think that effort at impartiality that some people condemn the media for, sort of both sides, like this was somehow equivalent to the investigation into Trump, was, I don't know, like,
you're mad at, you're still mad at him or not? I mean, you think he did something that unforgivable? Because I'll tell you what I think.
Okay.
I think he made a pretty good case for an honest mistake. He certainly made a good case that it was an honest decision, that, you know, he was fully conscious of these issues about affecting the election and that he was in this kind of impossible bind where if he didn't reveal it, it would be seen as a cover-up. And, of course, sharing the assumption that Hillary was likely to become president, he thought if it came out after, it could cast a cloud over his presidency.
Yeah.
And he's in this meeting with all these FBI people. They're all anguished about it, and there's no good decision. And he makes the call, and I think he made the wrong call. I don't think he should have made the October 29th announcement. But it's a decision you make on balance with pros and cons.
Yeah.
And it just seems to me like an honest misjudgment as opposed to anything worse than that.
And he
can't really
too
fault the guy for an honest misjudgment.
I think so. I think that's right. I mean, I will say also that, you know, 2 weeks ago, I created this Medium post to talk about all the suspects in the sort of crime that happened on November 8th, 2016, you know, who did it, who, like, you know, murdered the rightful president and installed, you know, our evil stepfather, Donald Trump. And, you know, 2 weeks ago, we all thought it was Mark Zuckerberg, and he owed us a million apologies for subverting democracy. And periodically, we think it's Hillary Clinton for not campaigning in Wisconsin or not understanding white working class rage. Sometimes people credit Trump for being brilliant and understanding, being a terrific strategist. People talk about districting, talk about the New York Times, you know, to blame. The New York Times recently, Amy Chozick, I think, in her book is saying, from what Comey says, it was bad data and reporting about the outcome of the election that led him to the confidence that Hillary would win. This wouldn't affect the outcome of the election. So Nate Silver's to blame or whoever. I think this is, if it's a murder mystery, I think it's Murder on the Orient Express.
they all did it.
They all did it.
They all did it together. All right. Well, any last thoughts about this book? I think this is not the TrumpCast Book Club. We have a TrumpCast Book Club where we read old books and novels that help you understand Trump. But Virginia, I love talking to you about the new books that are actually about what's been happening in the last year. I think we recommend it, right?
I'm going to say pretty hearty thumbs up. Yeah. I mean, I found it a page turner too. You know, I've like gotten stuck a little bit, to be honest, on Russian Roulette and some of the others where I've been following the reporting. But the content of James Comey's mind, just as a character, not as a is he good, is he bad, but just as you know, here's a man riven with doubt. And I mean, we were just talking about King Lear. It'll be really fascinating to see someone play Comey, an anguished, principled character that had a lot of responsibility and may have affected world history.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I try to read all the Trump books, and at any given time, you're either reading them because you have to or because you want to. And yeah. I wanted to be reading this pretty much all the way through. It's quite engaging and interesting.
Thanks so much for talking it through with me, Jacob.
Thank you, Virginia. It's been a pleasure.